Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. What you're about to hear in this video are a number of things that you've never heard before, and this is especially true for whites in southern Africa. The stuff here about Israel and Rhodesia and South Africa is stuff that has never seen the light of day. And the only source for it, the only person who's openly spoken about it, is the American that you're going to listen to. His name is J.B. Campbell. And J.B. Campbell was an American who came to Rhodesia in the 1970s. Initially, he came there for what you could say are business slash racial purposes, which was to try to bring whites into Rhodesia, because the white population was so small. And it's actually a brilliant idea. It's something we're going to revisit, because there are very, very important things about this concept. But for this video, I want you to hear Campbell talk about a number of things. And then there's some stuff that he doesn't talk about in the interview, but which he's written about. I have interviewed J.B. Campbell myself in the past, but in our long, long interview, we didn't get round to talking about this topic. And later on, I asked him if we could do an interview on this topic, and he wasn't interested. However, luckily, somebody in America found me an article that Campbell had written where he'd written about this. Because for me, this stuff about Israel is really big. However, I also want you to get a bit of a feel for this American who came to Africa and he joined our forces and he fought on the side of the whites. So Campbell came and he joined a thing called PATU, the Police Anti-Terrorist Unit. And he fought in Rhodesia for a year before leaving. And he even explains in here why he left, because he also talks about another secret. And I'll make some comments about some of these things afterwards, because these things themselves are big topics, but I don't want to get bogged down in them. The main thing I want to get through to you is the backstabbing nature of Israel. The whites of southern Africa are told, and they believe, that Israel was always on our side. But that's not true. And these Jews are two-faced scum. And if you look at them and their behavior at certain times, you'll realize that they are two-faced. And they're not just dealing with us, they're also dealing with the blacks. In fact, in the case of Zimbabwe, which is what Rhodesia came to be called when it ended up under black rule, Israel was a big buddy of Robert Mugabe, the communist who ran Zimbabwe. And Israel was doing all kinds of wheeling and dealing, and even selling of anti-riot equipment to the Zimbabwean government. And Israel also had a hand in diamonds and other things. There is even an instance where a Jewish company in South Africa was paid to rig the Zimbabwean election, and all the data came out a few years ago. These Jews have hobnobbed with our enemies. However, I'd like you to listen to this interview. This is not a full interview. This is an interview that J.B. Campbell did in 2016 with someone in the USA. I will later look at finding the interview that I did with him, because that also has got some interesting stuff in it. The only area where I differ with J.B. Campbell is with regard to the stuff that he says about Ian Smith. I will tell you that his data on the events in Rhodesia is completely correct, but I just differ on the interpretation regarding Ian Smith. And I'm not the only one. Dr. Peter Hammond, who was also there, he also has differences with people who say that Ian Smith was a traitor. Ian Smith was the Prime Minister of Rhodesia. But I will discuss these things a little bit after you've listened to J.B. Campbell. And Campbell isn't the only one that's called Ian Smith a traitor. Stephen Goodson in South Africa also called him a traitor. But Stephen Goodson's information is even worse. At least J.B. Campbell's data is correct. There's nothing wrong with his information. Goodson, on the other hand, has got various interpretations, which I've gone through, and I just totally disregard it. And I'll explain why later. This is not quite the same as the treason and the betrayal of the whites of South Africa. It was a whole different setup. Things were much tougher. But J.B. Campbell talks about a number of things, and I've also left part of the interview where he talks about America and Jews and things he learned and why he hates the American government, etc., etc. So there are many interesting things that he talks about that will give you a bit of background about things he learned through his life and how he came to be a racialist and pro-white, and he learned at the same time to absolutely hate the American government. So in that sense, Campbell is a really great example of an American who's fought in Rhodesia. There is another American who also fought in Rhodesia that I knew, and he was a captain, but on the topic of Jews and communism, there were differences that we had. But he also talked glowingly of the Rhodesians. I only know of about three Americans who've been in Rhodesia who've spoken about it in public. One of them I never got round to actually speaking to. But J.B. Campbell and the captain are two that I've spoken to. And Campbell tells you many interesting things. Also about the origins of the magazine Soldier of Fortune. Anyway, listen to this. I'll have some comments afterwards. And also take special note, he talks about a book that he wrote when he returned to America, and he called it The New American Man. And in there, he advocated that the white men of America must start arming up. And he says that he's the creator of the militia movement in America, that his book kicked off the militia movement. So that is also an example of how when you do things, it spreads to other nations. So from Rhodesia, from our tiny war, we have had a knock-on effect in America where white Americans have learned some things that are important to their future on the basis of what went wrong for us. And for me, this is just more proof that nothing that you ever do in life, even warfare itself, even death, that nothing that you do is actually a waste. As long as other whites take note of it, nothing is really a waste. But what is really nice about Campbell is that Campbell is a total racialist. He's totally only interested in whites, and he wants to see whites win. And for a time, he was among us, and it affected him. And also take note when he speaks about the spirit of the Rhodesians, because he says that Americans don't have anything like that, and it was something that touched him. And that is something that is very important to me as well. It's something I've also noticed that is a big difference between the white Rhodesians and the way most whites are in other countries. I think the only people who really knew what it was like to really stick together were the Germans in World War II. The Germans have got that sort of tightness. And I'd say that the Germans were much tighter as a nation and a group than any other whites on the planet. And nobody knows what it's like to be in that sort of situation. But in the English-speaking world, And outside of Europe, I think the Rhodesians are the only ones who've actually experienced that spirit. And I must tell you, it's the one thing about Rhodesia that I never forget. For me, the spirit of Rhodesia and what it was like to be there among other whites and everybody's sticking together, it's really a fantastic thing. It's really awesome. It is so unbelievably different and totally the opposite of the way the United States is, the way England is, the way modern whites are. It's a completely different world, and there is something in there, a bond that is amazing. And it is the kind of bond that all whites need to develop. Because if all of us stick together, and we really stick together, then I don't believe that anything can destroy us or prevent us from having a really bright future. But listen carefully to J.B. Campbell. He says some interesting stuff. He talks about a lot of interesting stuff.
Could you kind of walk us through the timeline and, you know, explain how you got down to South Africa? I mean, what prompted you to go down there and take this position with the police down there?
Yeah, actually, it was Rhodesia.
Okay, and, Rhodesia, okay.
Country right above South Africa. Today, he calls Zimbabwe because we lost. But I went down there in 71 on a business trip. I was about 23 years old at the time. And I was sent down by a company in Carson City, Nevada, a land development deal. I didn't work out, but I discovered what was going on in Rhodesia. So I came back and worked for a while and corresponded with the Rhodesian Army and wanted to be an officer because I kind of seen these guys when I was there. Thought, that looks kind of interesting. So they said, fine. But at the last minute, they said, hey, you're going to be 26 when this officer training program starts in January 73. So you're going to be too old. Well, I turned 26 in a couple of weeks earlier. So I went anyway and tried to talk him into letting me join up. They said, no, we have our rules. So he told me about the police had something called a support unit, which was an anti-terrorist squad. And I went over to the police headquarters and made a deal with them. They let me go into the police. But I said, I don't want to be a cop or anything. I just, you know, I want to go into a support unit. They said, how'd you hear about that? I said, the Army guy told me. Oh, well, no, you're not, you know, you got to be kind of senior and you have to have more experience with Africans. So I said, well, that's the only thing I want to do. So they, long story short, they finally let me do that. I had to do 6 months in uniform branch to get to know about Africans. And then they let me go into support unit, which was full-time anti-terrorist work. It was like the Army, but it was a lot better, had a lot more independence.
So it was an anti-terrorism unit that was a part of the police force? Is that the
order? Exactly. Okay, exactly. Right, it was the British South Africa Police, which was the, you know, the old traditional name for the police force. And support unit was just their full-time anti-terror squad.
Now, what kind of terrorists were you guys dealing with? I mean, what was going on at the time down there?
Well, there were two groups. One was backed by the Soviet Union. One was backed by Red China. And the one where I was, up in Mashonaland, they were backed by Red China. And they were really the real deal. I mean, they were pretty horrible people, killing mostly their fellow Africans. But every night they would some gang would attack some white farmer in the what they call the Sharp End. With the northeast border area with Mozambique. And that's where I was stationed in the uniform branch. And then a support unit, that's where I operated, was in the northeast border area. And they were just, sadistic monsters, natural African cruelty combined with this Jewish communism. It was just unbelievable. Of course, it's what we're seeing now with ISIS, but that's what they were doing back then. against both blacks and whites.
Unbelievable. So were the were both of these groups, these communist groups, were they openly trying to overthrow the government and, you know, implement a communist government in Rhodesia, for example?
Yeah, that was the idea.
Right.
The Chinese-backed group up north was, you know, trying to take over the government, and this one, the Matabele-based group down south, was backed by the Soviets. And Jimmy Carter and I think the American government and the British government assumed that the Matabele group down south would take over the Soviet-backed group, because traditionally they had always kind of lorded it over the Mashana tribesmen up north. But when you got one man, one vote, which was imposed by Carter and company, Mashana had more people. So Robert Mugabe, he was the head of that group, and they won the so-called elections. So they took over.
Wow. Now, how long were you involved in this anti-terrorist police unit?
It was a couple of years, 73 and 74.
Okay, a couple of years. And, I mean, generally speaking, what was your experience like? I mean, were you seeing combat on a daily basis, or what was a general, you know, a day's work? What, you know, could you kind of walk us through just an average day?
Well, we did six-week patrols, and that would be out in the bush, either setting up ambushes or protecting other actual policemen on their investigations, because the terror war was run as a police operation. The police would go out and gather up the empty cartridge casings and all the other evidence in case we captured somebody down the road, and then it would be used against him in court. So it was a legal deal. It didn't become a full-on army operation until I think after I left. So the police were really in charge of this at the time. And we do 6 weeks out in the bush, and then a week off, a week back in headquarters, and kind of retrain our men and get them back up to speed again to do kind of drills and anti-ambush drills, and then back out of the bush for 6 weeks. So that was the routine.
Wow. Yeah, that'd be grinding.
Yeah.
What were some of the main lessons that you learned from doing this for 2 years?
Well, you know, we learned about ambushes and counter ambushes, of course. Naturally, that was the main activities we were involved in. But I also did a 6 week patrol at a secret prison camp down south called Gonarezu or Villa Salazar. And this is where Joshua Nkomo and the leadership of the Southern group were held in detention. And I saw while I was there for 6 weeks that these terrorists, these Soviet-backed terrorists, were being groomed for leadership. You know, they had classes in government and civics and history and world affairs and all this stuff by the white government that I was serving, Ian Smith government. They were actually preparing these characters for leadership
at this prison, you mean?
Yes.
Wow.
And that, boy, I thought, gee, many Christmas, what the hell am I doing here? This is a sellout.
Yeah.
This is a sellout. This is what is happening. And Henry Kissinger at that point, within a few months of my seeing this, he ordered Ian Smith to let Joshua Nkomo and his 45 senior commanders go free. And, of course, I never heard of Robert Mugabe when I was there. He was in detention up in Salisbury, up in the capital. And he was also let go. And this was unbelievable. I thought, I'm going to get killed for a sellout. So I bought out my contract about a year early. I was the most gung-ho guy there. I was like a real Rhodesian patriot. Mm-hmm. But when I saw this betrayal, and when I got back to Mount Darwin up in the farming area where I hung out quite a bit, where I was in the police, the regular police before I went in the support unit, I had a lot of farmer friends up there. So we had a meeting, and I tried to tell him what I'd seen at this secret prison camp run by the police. It wasn't even run by the Bureau of Prisons or anything. It was run by the police because it was secret. And they didn't believe me. I said, no, no, they would never do that. I said, look, I'm telling you, I saw the classroom. I was there. They just couldn't believe it. So I thought, boy, I really made a mistake here. So,
and you know, that is something that's been going on in the United States and in Europe even, and you know, all across the world for so long. The communists took over the U.S. federal government and totally infiltrated it, you know, under the FDR administration. And this has been proven in you know, by the FBI even. The FBI was investigating this, and all the documents are available now. And most of these people that were involved with the Roosevelt administration were all communist agents. And, I mean, there was many other influential communist agents all throughout American society, in the media, you know, in the nonprofit world, you name it. So, you know, this is something that's been going on all across the world. And, you know, you try to tell people about it, or, you know, you see it firsthand in Rhodesia, for example. And you try to tell, you know, the patriots, the people you think are patriots around you, and they don't even believe you.
No, it's too bizarre. It's too unbelievable. So you're right. Now, when I was on that trip in 71, you know, 2 years on that land development deal, I met with the Rhodesian Minister of Internal Affairs named Jack Howman. And he said, because the proposal was for a bunch of white people basically to come to Rhodesia if they would give breaks on taxes and no conscription, no draft. So this Minister of Internal Affairs said, well, we could never agree to such a thing. You know, we can't exempt a whole group of people from our laws. I said, well, you need people here. You got to have some incentive for them to come. Then he said to me, well, I must tell you that had been in office when you made this proposal, it would probably have been successful. But change has come to Rhodesia. It's in 1971. I said, by change, sir, do you mean international socialism? He just stared at me. But that was what was coming, because, you know, Ian Smith, the prime minister, had said, when they declared independence from England in 65, he'd said there will never be majority rule, meaning African rule, in Rhodesia in my lifetime. But within a few years, of course, that's exactly what he ushered in. So it was a sellout. It was a wonderful adventure for me personally, and for a lot of guys like me from England and South Africa that came up there, and for Rhodesians too. It was a wonderful thing to do. Probably the most significant thing I've ever done, personally.
Yeah, but, I bet it was definitely an interesting experience, and it had a profound impact on your life, it sounds like.
It did, and it really, when I started this militia movement, that's really what I was trying to recreate, was this camaraderie that we had. It was really great, which you don't see in America, I don't think, but we definitely had it there, because we were up against it. You know, it was the first country that had United Nations sanctions imposed on it. In other words, starvation sanctions trying to bring us to our knees. If it weren't for South Africa and Mozambique, in other words, Portugal, it would have worked. But they broke the sanctions and allowed certain things to come into the country, and for oil, for example, to come in from Mozambique and South Africa. So, anyway.
Very interesting. Now, you came back to the United States, and it sounds like you worked for a while before you wrote your book, The New American Man, A Call to Arms. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, as I say, you know, I've been an enemy of the United States government since around 1968, I would say. I mean, I learned to hate this government back when I was in college at the University of Nevada, Reno. So I had a little...
I'm sorry. Could you explain what drove you to hate the U.S. government? Could you explain that real briefly? I mean, what were you learning about at the time, or what, you know, what led you to this conclusion?
Well, I lived in England. I was over there in England racing cars, you know, 67. And I started reading about politics and communism. And I had no idea, really, of what, that America was behind communism, that America had imposed communism on Russia in 1917.
Yes.
And then the more I studied, I studied the Hungarian Revolution, and you know, how America betrayed the Hungarians, and then what America did to Germany in two wars, and America being on the Soviet side in the World War II, being a military allies with the Soviet Union. I thought, oh my God, you know, this is, my God, how do we deal with this? And as time went on, I just realized that I was a revolutionary. I mean, this government, this American government, is so rotten and deceptive and pro-communist and responsible for communism everywhere since 1917. I mean, every single communist dictatorship that was set up since 1917 was done so by the United States State Department, including Red China, including Vietnam, including North Korea, including Castro. That guy, Bob Brown, who had Soldier Fortune magazine, you know, he came over and interviewed me in Salisbury in 74 before this magazine ever existed. He was freelancing. And that interview became the first magazine, first Soldier Fortune. I didn't even know about the magazine for another year and a half. So somebody pulled it out and said, hey, is this you? Had no idea. But he told me that he was in special forces in the 50s. This Bob Brown, Robert K. Brown. He told me that he was in special forces and he had participated in running guns to Castro and assassinating Trujillo down in the Dominican Republic. I said, you ran guns to Castro for the CIA? Right. He said, yeah, in 58. Really? Okay. Wow. So, you know, those kinds of things started piling up in my brain. And I realized, oh, my God, you know, this country, this government is so vicious and so murderous and deceptive. And anyway,
right.
It has to be overthrown.
It's incredible what they've been doing for, I mean, we're supposed to be fighting the communists, yet we're supporting them and financing them and setting up communist governments all over the world. It's just totally out of control. When you were studying communism, did you recognize the Jewish nature of it?
Well, not at first, because unfortunately, back in those days, the main source for information was the John Birch Society.
Right.
And I didn't join them. My father was a member, a life member, but I read their material. And then I'd been drilling oil wells. I worked for ARCO for 4 years, and then the Birch Society came to me and asked me to work for them, which I did do. For a year, I was a coordinator for the Birch Society in Los Angeles. And that's when I discovered that the Birch Society was, you know, a Zionist organization. I had no knowledge of it. I didn't realize that Robert Welch was a Mason and was kissing Israel's rear end, calling Menachem Begin the George Washington of Israel, all this crap. So that was the unfortunate part about learning about communism in the United States, if you learned it through the John Birch Society.
They didn't connect all the dots and really give you the full picture of what communism was all about.
No.
I mean, I basically view communism as there's a man I follow named Bill Fink, and he's described communism very accurately, in my opinion, as the political and economic expression of the Jewish Talmud, where every Jew is a bureaucrat or, you know, some tyrant, and every non-Jew, every goyim is a slave to the Jew. That's basically what communism amounts to. That's certainly how it was practiced in Russia. And, you know, we've seen other countries where basically, you know, the communists come to power and it's just one big mafia. They just take over everything. They silence and even murder anyone that dissents or anyone that stands up to them. It's a total, you know, tyranny. That's basically what communism is.
Yeah, and now that's what America has become. I mean, yep. America, you know, the Ayatollah said it was the great Satan. It is. It's the most evil government in the history of the world, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, look at the way the whole America was based. It was based on extermination of the native population and slavery. That was the basis of America. You just can't get around that. We got a lot to live down. We've got to face these ugly facts and somehow deal with that, and also make sure that we never participate in such things. But that's exactly what the American government does now. Mm-hmm. It's destroyed how many governments in the past 10 years or 12, you know, since 9/11.
Right.
It's
disgraceful. It's shameful. I mean, I'm just appalled at what the government's done. It just, even in my lifetime, I mean, let alone going back throughout history, it's really shameful. And see, this is what saddens me, is I think that Americans, generally speaking, are some of the most hardworking and productive and honest people out there. But we just have this totally tyrannical and frankly, Jewish-controlled government. And we have all these traitors and sellouts in key positions of power. And we've just failed to deal seriously with these problems. We don't want it. Most people don't want to hear about it. They'd rather watch football or watch TV. You know, it's shameful.
You know, I had a big trouble trying to put my finger on what America has become. Who these people are, these Dick Cheneys and these Rumsfelds and these neocons. What the hell are these? And of all people, Paul Craig Roberts, you know, finally made it so that I could grasp it. I mean, I knew basically what was going on, but he said, you know, these neocons, it's a polite word for Jews, have no, once the Soviet Union ceased to exist, then America became the superpower with these people at the helm. And they wanted total world domination through the American military. I said, okay, yeah, that's what I've been trying to deal with. It is these faceless, gray, little pencil neck people like Cheney. I mean, imagine Dick Cheney. What the hell?
Right.
Donald Rumsfeld, Douglas Feith, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz. I mean, who the hell are these nasty,
these evil,
murderous
men.
People.
Yeah.
They wanted total world domination with the U.S. military backing them up. And so, of course, I credit or blame the Council on Foreign Relations. That's because all these people belong to that rotten, vile organization, which I say has to be destroyed. And all the thousands of members have to be eliminated because they're the cancer. They're the ones who have destroyed the world and destroyed America. But mostly they destroyed the world using American might.
Now, could you talk more about the Council on Foreign Relations? Is it, say it one more time. What is the name of the organization?
It's the Council on Foreign Relations New York and Washington and Chicago.
Okay, right. And this is, from what I understand, is this sort of the American version of the British Royal Society?
Yeah, it was based on that. It was, see, the founders were the guys who controlled Woodrow Wilson back from 1913 through 1920, whatever it was, when Harding came in. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones that gave us World War I. They gave us the Federal Reserve. They gave us the graduated income tax and a bunch of other horrible things that destroyed America and much of the world with World War I. But the whole goal of that World War I was to have this world government they called the League of Nations. And the League of Nations was formed, but it did not, the American did not join it. And this enraged these guys, So they started, by 1921, they started this thing called the Council on Foreign Relations, which had the goal of another world government organization following another world war. And that's what they plotted. And for 20 years, from 1921, you know, less than 20 years, they got us into this horrible conflagration, this catastrophe called World War II.
Right. Yes.
And out of that came their grand design of the United Nations organization, UNO. Mm-hmm. So that was the goal and the achieved goal of the Council on Foreign Relations. But since then, of course, they control they're like the employment agency for the federal government. And they put their people into key positions so that virtually everything from the White House down is controlled and run by this private organization called the Council on Foreign Relations, which is financed by the Rockefellers and the Carnegie Endowment and mm-hmm. Ford Foundation, you know.
So, right. And yeah, you'll see this. You'll see, you know, a lot of the top advisors, you know, in the White House and working for the, you know, executive branch and even other branches of the government, they are connected to the Council of Foreign Relations. So it's, they definitely seem to have their assets in key positions of power. There's no doubt about that. And also they're very influential, in the media. And a lot of these, big time journalists and publishers are part of this organization.
Yeah. Everything from educators to military, you know, key military guys, everybody who's anybody has to belong to the Council of Foreign Relations. So that is the conspiracy. That's the umbrella group that controls our government. It's unaccountable. It's private. It's the ultimate NGO. So
okay, that you know, and that's interesting. I really don't know a whole lot about the organization because. I just frankly haven't done a lot of research into it. But from where I sit and what I'm seeing, I see basically Jews controlling the American government. What role do you see the Israel lobby? And you know, you said neocon is basically a nice word for a Jew. You know, what role do you see the Jews playing in the destruction of America?
Well, the report is, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations, for example, is 70% Jewish membership. I mean, that's the tip-off. Because
it's pretty,
Jews are supposed
it's
to
pretty telling, 2%, yeah.
2% of the population, they control 70% or more of this sinister private group that runs the government. But so does AIPAC. You know, AIPAC runs the Congress. America, Israel, Political Affairs, Political Action Committee, whatever it's called, Political Affairs Committee. The Anti-Defamation League runs everything as far as television and education. Everything has to be controlled or passed by the Anti-Defamation League.
They're even training our law enforcement guys, state police, you know, exactly. FBI. Yeah.
Yeah, everything.
Now that you've heard a bit of what J.B. Campbell had to say, I don't really want to get into big discussions about the various things that he said. But there may be some interesting things that you heard in there. And I agree with a lot of what he says. The only real thing that he says that's a big problem for me is his criticism of Ian Smith. This guy that you see here, this is Ian Smith. He was the Prime Minister of Rhodesia. And Campbell makes probably the greatest argument of anybody that Smith had some secret deals going on. But nobody knows what those deals are. We don't know exactly what's going on. And he himself only said certain things as well, even in his biography. But Campbell does say some very interesting things about the black terrorist leaders that were being kept there and that they weren't really being badly treated. They weren't like in a proper prison. You see, one of the things is that you must remember that Rhodesia rebelled against Britain, and Rhodesia was a colony, even though it was a self-governing colony run by whites. The fact of the matter is that nobody in the world recognized Rhodesia as an independent state. And if you rebel against your motherland or fatherland, they can come and invade you. And in fact, that was one of the options of the British. The one thing that I will say at this point, because I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, the one thing I will say is that it is an amazingly dangerous task for guys like Smith and the leaders of Rhodesia to openly and publicly rebel against Britain. These guys could have been up for treason. We could have been invaded and smashed by Britain. And Britain had the means to come and crush us any time they wanted. There was therefore a lot of mental games involved in this issue of rebelling against Britain. And one of the calculations that Smith did, and this is documented, is that Smith came to the conclusion, he was quite certain, that if Rhodesia rebelled, that certain sentiment inside Britain would prevent the British government from actually coming and crushing us physically. So the British ended up running off to the United Nations and using world sanctions and using the Royal Navy, etc., to stop oil coming to Rhodesia, etc. And Britain did these things and it harmed us and it made life tough for us and we couldn't buy weapons, etc. But these were calculated risks that these guys took. And if these risks had been miscalculated, we could have been invaded by Britain. Britain could have come and handed us over to the blacks and physically bombed us if they'd wanted to. So these are among the tricky games that you play, and whites will have to play these same tricky games in the future. Hitler played tricky games. All of these things are dangerous games. And you've got to be up on your game to even survive. It is therefore quite a miracle that a country with so few whites were able to rebel openly against Britain and survive and spit in Britain's face. And we were lucky that we had allies like the Portuguese and the South Africans who ignored certain international restrictions. And that allowed us to survive. If the Portuguese, for example, didn't allow oil tankers to deliver oil, we would not have had any oil at all. And later, even that was cut off, and all we had left was South Africa. The whole thing of rebelling is a very dangerous game. And in modern times, there's nothing like this. I think the Irish rebelled against the British in 1916. And won a war against them. You know, if you rebel, you can be attacked by the country that you're rebelling against. Ask the Americans, how did 1776 go? You know, British army on your soil, busy killing you. So this was a dangerous, dangerous game. And what we don't know is all of the diplomacy and cunning that these guys maybe used in order to play games, in order to buy time for us. We don't know all the things. I'm sure that there are still secrets about Rhodesia and secrets about South Africa that have never been let out, that you don't know all the things the leaders did of the whites. But Campbell makes some good points. The guy who criticizes Smith the most is Stephen Goodson of South Africa. I've read Goodson's criticisms and they're completely wrong. It's the one thing that Goodson wrote that's just total nonsense. Somebody went and made a whole story to him and it makes no sense whatsoever. In fact, the arguments used against Ian Smith are the same arguments used against Hitler. It basically boils down to the fact that you lost, therefore your leader was a traitor. And I've heard those arguments made about Hitler. It's all junk. You know, Hitler didn't set out to destroy Germany. Ian Smith didn't set out to destroy Rhodesia. These are dangerous, dangerous games, and that the whites managed to pull this off is itself an incredible feat. That a colony of the British Empire, a little white colony, stood up and said, you know, we're going our own way. We're not going to listen to you. This stuff was not an easy game. So one doesn't know all the things that happened. And Rhodesia had strong links to Britain. There were lots of Rhodesians who liaised with Britain at all levels. So they knew the British well, make no mistake, all of these guys. And they took a risk. Everything in life that means anything is a risk. It's dangerous, can get you killed. If you want real stuff in the world to happen, you have to know that you can get killed. Or these guys could have been charged with treason against Britain and maybe thrown in jail. You know, it's amazing that none of these things happened to any of them. And there is other stuff about these black leaders that I will show you, that there was a real traitor in Rhodesia, and the army guys were onto who might have been the real traitor when it comes to the stuff of the black leaders. Because there was a time where even though Campbell says that the black leaders were treated well, and later Kissinger, the Jew from America, the Secretary of State, told us to let these blacks go. Even though Kissinger came and totally screwed it up for us by doing that and using South Africa to force us to do that, there were times when the whites of Rhodesia set out to kill those same black leaders. And as our troops went to kill them, suddenly somebody tipped them off. And there are guys who talk about who was the real traitor in Rhodesia. And the real traitor that the military guys were sure was the guy really selling us out was the guy who headed our intelligence organization, a guy called Ken Flower. So there are many, many things about Rhodesia that are complicated, just like South Africa. And I would not easily say that Smith was a traitor or that he set out to destroy us. They bet everything, including their own lives and their own properties. They all lived in Rhodesia. They all had to stay there and live with the consequences of what happened. They didn't have money to go and rush off to other countries. This guy did not leave the country, and he told the whites not to leave the country. So that's just a bit of background there. So that'll give you a bit of an idea of Campbell. But Campbell is good because he also tells you other things. And Campbell tells you about the spirit of the Rhodesians, that Rhodesians had a good spirit, that Rhodesians really had a great spirit. And that's the thing that I myself miss the most about Rhodesia. Rhodesia had a fantastic spirit. The whites stuck together. We had enemies, and regardless of what happened, there were very few who after the time turned round and knifed each other in the back. Most Rhodesians never knifed anybody in the back. We believed in ourselves. And even after everything was lost, we didn't go and call people names and set out to destroy people. Rhodesians took the beating with, I don't want to call it good humor, but they took their beatings and they didn't cry about it too much and didn't run around calling everybody a traitor. And there was a certain trust that we had in each other as a group. And I think the only whites of modern times who truly lived like that were the whites of Germany, the Germans. the Germans had a real team spirit that was second to none. But I think Rhodesians could come a close second. And perhaps in the days of the Confederates, when they were fighting in the South in America, they probably also had a lot of a good team spirit sticking together. Well, white people can do it. And for me, the team spirit of Rhodesia was the greatest thing of all. And believe it or not, this guy, he might not be the greatest looking guy in the world, but believe it or not, this guy, he came on TV and we listened to him. And we trusted him with our lives, with everything. And he had a lot more balls than most every other politician in the world today. This guy had much more, he had much more guts than any other leader that you'll find in the Western world. And he openly said that blacks should never be allowed to rule Rhodesia. He said that, and you can actually hear it. But anyway, I want to get on to some other stuff from Campbell. I had interviewed Campbell myself, and I'd interviewed him about Smith. Now, I wanted to interview Campbell, and I did interview him once for a long period of time, and we spoke about a lot of aspects of Rhodesia. But there's something I really wanted out of Campbell. And that was that I heard that another thing that Campbell had mentioned was that Rhodesia had been stabbed in the back by Israel. In all my time of studying South African and Rhodesian history, I'd never come across the notion that Israel had stabbed us in the back. Israel was supposedly a friend of Rhodesia, though I don't really know of anything. Maybe a submachine gun might be the only thing that we got out of Israel, maybe. A type of submachine gun, maybe. Whereas South Africa had a lot of relations with Israel. But in the time of Rhodesia, we understood Israel's our friend. But to be honest with you, I don't know of anything physical that came from Israel to Rhodesia. I do know that the Jews of Rhodesia were allowed to send money to Israel. That was allowed. And yes, the Jews sent lots of money to Israel to build up their state. But anyway, what I wanted was, what I really wanted out of Campbell, which he didn't give me, was I wanted him to talk about Israel. And we did this hell of a long interview and we went into lots and lots of detail. And then we ended the thing, and when I wanted to interview him again to talk especially about Israel, he declined. So unfortunately, I had to find other sources where Campbell had spoken about Israel. And one of my friends in America found an article that Campbell had written in a magazine called the Liberty Bell, where he wrote about Rhodesia, and in there we can see some things. So some things are like in this interview that you've heard where he also talked about Christian missionaries getting killed. So there are some parts of this article that I'm going to read to you, even though at the end is the critical part, the part about Israel. So let's just go on and get into that stuff. So this is the part of the article entitled Rhodesia by J.B. Campbell, which was published in an American magazine, conservative magazine, right-wing magazine, called the Liberty Bell. So I'm just going to read a couple of things for you. We all know what happened to Rhodesia. It became Zimbabwe, but it didn't have to happen. A land development company in Carson City sent me to British Honduras, South Africa, and Rhodesia in 1971. To discuss with each government the purchase of a minimum of 100 square miles for the creation of a white enclave of Europeans, Canadians, and Americans who were fed up with their regulated, taxed, and racially mixed lives. The company proposed that the new immigrants must be exempt from all taxes and the country's military draft, there had to be some incentive for white people to relocate. Let me pause there. This is a brilliant, genius idea of basically bringing Americans and Canadians and Europeans to some place in Africa and allowing them to move and giving them some financial benefit for moving to here. I think this is fantastic. I'd never actually heard of such a concept until I heard it out of the mouth of Campbell. I think it's fantastic. And I think that the plan basically was a flop. Nobody actually did anything for them, neither South Africa nor Rhodesia, which is quite sad, really, given what happened. And Campbell was right, you know. You need more people. And absolutely true, the whites needed more people. But anyway, that is how Campbell got to travel to Rhodesia and South Africa. So I'm just going to read a little bit more. You can see here that this article was in the Liberty Bell in November 1993. So on page 17 it says, at any time in the early 1970s, there were between 400 to 600 terrorists roaming around in gangs of 5 to 20 in strength. Hundreds more were being trained in Chinese and Soviet camps in Mozambique, Zambia, and Tanzania. These terrorists committed the most hideous atrocities, the results of combining Jewish doctrine with normal African cruelty. The typical punishment for any African accused by terrorists of helping us was the slicing off of his nose, ears, lips, and genitals. The victim's wife then had to cook and eat the whole mess. White victims were hacked to death or merely shot full of holes. The bayonet was typically used because it was slower, and if we were around, he's probably meaning the military, quieter. My racial feelings were obviously healthy at the beginning of this adventure, or else I wouldn't have been there. Let me just pause there. He means that he was very white orientated. And that is fantastic. There were some Americans who came there like him who were there for the sake of helping whites. And that was really awesome. You know, it was awesome that guys like him came to Rhodesia. And he says, but they really weren't developed. I was proud to be fighting for white supremacy, of course, but I hadn't realized the profound meaning of race or the vast chasm that cuts between us and the nignogs. That's his term for the blacks. It wasn't until I had to deal with the victims of terrorism that I began to notice that I was not particularly bothered by the deaths of Africans. Again, he means blacks. The sight, though, of a dead white sickened and enraged me. I saw the African as the ultimate consumer, as destructive as a baboon, and totally dependent upon the white man. The sadistic pleasure they take in killing a man and beast was proof that they do not deserve to live. Rhodesia was struck by an outbreak of typhoid and cholera in 1973. Only the Africans were affected, and for a while they were dropping dead like flies of their filthy habits. The black population had swollen to 5.5 million, which was all the fault of the white man's insane subsidies. Let me pause there. He's quite right. You see, whites everywhere, and it's a topic we'll get back to, whites and labor, and whites and economics, and whites and slaves, whites everywhere end up using either cheap labor of non-whites or slaves. This is a thing that goes back a long, long time, even to the Romans and the Greeks. And so when we've got these workers, we looked after them. We looked after them so well that they multiplied in vast numbers. We cured their illnesses. We stopped them dying from disease. And ultimately, this backfired on us. because the moment that they outnumbered us in large enough amounts, then they were easily turned against us. Whereas when we got there, the whites who went there, there weren't that many blacks when whites came to Africa. It is whites with medical facilities, food, looking after the blacks, etc., that actually increased their population. We destroyed ourselves by making them strong. But the other side of the coin is that the whites of Africa struggled with an immigration problem. Most whites chose to go to North America because it wasn't as dangerous as Africa. In Africa, people died from disease in a big way, including whites. And so most whites from Europe did not come to Africa because of the disease. But later on, whites started fixing this, and white science overcame this. And then the black population exploded within a couple of decades. It exploded upwards. So anyway, he says, and I recall being extremely cheered and hopeful that the cleansing epidemic would carry on. Alas, it petered out. AIDS has been touted as the great white hope, but it is now reported that even this pandemic cannot overcome the phenomenal African birth rate. Only starvation can cure the problem. There are many things to say about AIDS and why AIDS didn't end up killing all the blacks. It kills a small amount, like 50,000 a year or so in South Africa, but it doesn't kill the hundreds of millions that we'd hoped for. The peak white population, this is of Rhodesia, was 270,000, or 1/20th of the African. This is true. The blacks outnumbered us 24-1. South Africa's white population is roughly 1/8 of the African. Much of this disparity was instigated by the political niggers encouraging the tribal coons to overcome the goddamned white man by sheer numbers. Let me just pause there. This is true. The blacks actually viewed having babies as a way of waging war against us. Blacks here in South Africa, who, when my mom lived in the Orange Free State, blacks in the Orange Free State actually openly told my mother this in the 1980s. This is true. The blacks viewed their babies as a way of fighting against us. And we ourselves need to have babies. We don't have enough. So he continues, also contributing to the problem was the great illegal immigration from neighboring black countries. South Africa and Rhodesia were plagued by this immigration because it was widely known that work, money, and benefits were to be had there. Let me pause again. Basically, blacks from black countries ruled by blacks fled to the white countries of Southern Africa. Now, all these decades later, you get blacks from Africa fleeing to Europe and America for the same reasons. These blacks follow us. They're like the Jews. They follow us. They come to our countries because our countries are well run. And the irony is these blacks are fleeing from black countries that are run by blacks to come and work elsewhere. And they flee to wherever the white man is. This is how it works. And now it works like that on an even greater scale. They're going all across the Western world. Perhaps the greatest institutional responsibility for African unrest. Let me just pause here. This is going to be important. This is the Christian missionaries. I thought I'd just mention this because this is good. Perhaps the greatest institutional responsibility for African unrest and dissatisfaction lay with the Christian missionaries from England, America, and the European countries. All the African children went to mission schools and were taught to read and write in English and their own language and to love Jesus. They were kept in these schools until the sixth grade, whereupon they were released and encouraged to get a job, now having been educated. That the way he wrote that word, the emphasis is on the Jew. Educated. Anyway, the problem was that with a 20-to-1 ratio of employees to employers, jobs were not easy to find, and they certainly didn't pay very much. My Batman is an English term. It's like for somebody who's your helper. He's your personal, almost like a personal slave. So he says, my Batman, for example, received $14 per month, on which he supported a wife and a child. He was overpaid by a couple of dollars to boot. My pay was the princely sum of $250 per month, plus combat pay. So this is gives you an idea of how different the pay structures were. But again, I'm not going to go into how economics worked in the colonies. And he says his guy was paid $14 plus some extras. The average black in Rhodesia was paid $10 a month. And he's right about these figures. The average white earned about $300 per month. So anyway, besides this unrealistic expectation which the missionaries created, they filled the Africans' little minds with the same anti-white garbage that children in all other countries are forced to swallow in their churches and Sunday schools. Happily, a number of these holy poisoners, the priests, were being bumped off by the terrorists. The irony was that the missions were in the majority supporting the black bastards. Let me just pause there. Here, Campbell makes a very interesting point, and I've got the photos to prove this, is that these Christian missionaries came to Africa, and they went into all these remote areas, and they started helping the blacks. They started teaching them. They did more than just teach them. They gave them medicines. They helped them with all kinds of things, and they taught them. And then, of course, they filled these blacks with liberal values. And so they started telling these blacks that these blacks are equal to whites, etc. And, you know, we're all brothers in Jesus and all that kind of stuff. And then these blacks start wanting all the stuff that the whites have. So the irony is you have all these foreign Christian missionaries coming to Africa, educating the blacks for free, helping them, giving them medicine. And then they're also turning them into liberals who now want a piece of the pie. Previously, these blacks weren't even knowledgeable and they didn't even know. And they didn't know about human rights or anything. So you now come and you educate them, and by the time he's finished, he sees himself as equal to you, and then he says, well, I want what you have. You know, you owe me this, you know. Why are you treating me like this? So once you move down the path of equality, the sudden thing that you get is that suddenly you've turned him into your enemy. He's now saying, but hey, you're not treating me right, etc. This is the problem with liberalism. And until the liberals and the Christians come, these blacks didn't know better, and they understood that you were the boss, you were dominant, and they listened to you, and they respected you. But once liberals and Christians are finished with them, they no longer respect you, and they see themselves as your equals. And the next thing is they want to start sleeping with your wives and so forth. It opens up a whole bunch of doors that weren't a problem before. And liberalism cannot solve these problems. Liberalism creates all these unnatural expectations for the blacks, which cannot be satisfied economically. You cannot satisfy it. We're a colony. We're living in Africa. We don't have much infrastructure. We don't have much income. How are we going to live with this? How are we going to get the money to these blacks? Even a country like America, with a huge population of whites and vast wealth, even it struggles to deliver to the blacks that which they are expecting, thanks to liberalism. Even big, rich, wealthy countries of whites, which have got tens of millions, and in the case of America, 200 million whites, even they struggle to support the expectations of liberalism. Liberalism is very expensive. Communism is also expensive. How the hell can you do it when the blacks outnumber the whites more than 20 to 1? How can you then do it? We don't have the taxpayer base to do these things. And the same is true to South Africa to a lesser degree. It's also true there. So anyway, that's just some thoughts on these missions, and Christianity doesn't work so well. It creates lots of problems. It doesn't always work the way that you think it'll work. So here he tells a very fascinating story. At one point, I was ordered to visit an American mission, which had been causing us a lot of trouble, us being Rhodesians. I'd put this off for a month because I really couldn't stand being around them. However, one day I loaded 6 askari into the back of a support unit Land Rover and headed into the deadly Chesa tribal trust land. So these are like the American reservations for the Indians, where only the blacks live. Huge chunks of territory where they live for free. They don't have to pay for anything. Into the deadly Chesa tribal trust land. I had with me a Boer friend, Willem van der Merwe, along as a witness. You see, there were some Boers in Rhodesia, us being some of them. A TTL, a tribal trust land, was an African reserve in which a white had no business unless he was a missionary or in the security forces, the army. Presently, we came to the offending mission, and I parked the truck. The missionary's wife, a frumpy but cheerful American, came out to greet us. Rather, she greeted my Africans and finally remembered Willem and me. She wasn't so cheerful with us. So she's all friendly with the blacks, not so friendly to the whites. But listen to what happens. What can I do for you? She asked coolly. I introduced ourselves and said, I'm an American also, and I've been asked to come to see you. Well, she said, would you care for tea? Willem and I were led to the foyer of the mission and no further. We sat and waited for our tea. In fact, we waited until my Africans had been pointedly served first outside. So this American mission Christian serves the blacks first and makes the whites wait, okay? But listen to what happens. It was probably the first tea they'd ever tasted. Finally, the holy cow came into the foyer and sat. Is your husband here? I asked. No, I'm sorry. Well, ma'am, I said, I've been asked to come over and talk to you about the terrorists in this area. There are no terrorists around here, she stated, obviously excepting myself. The problem is that we have killed terrorists who were wearing bracelets from your mission hospital here. So you see, the Rhodesian army is killing terrorists, and those terrorists have been treated by the Christian missionaries. In fact, probably terrorists are injured in combat and end up going to the missionaries, who then assist and cure our enemies. So the army is now getting sick and tired of this, and so they want to talk to these American Christians and say, stop doing this, okay? So he says, the problem is that we have killed terrorists who were wearing bracelets from your mission hospital here. And she says, it is our obligation to help the wounded, whatever their politics. So Campbell says, yes, well, the fact is that you are aiding the enemy in time of war, you and the other missions. The Rhodesian government will not put up with this much longer. They are naturally reluctant to crack down on Christian missionaries, but you are not giving them much choice. She knew I was bluffing and just looked at me. The missionaries had gotten away with such subversion at this point that they knew they'd never be run off. They were part of the plan. I disagree with that comment that they were part of the plan. But he's saying that the whites, who are Christians themselves, will never chase the other white Christian missionaries out of the country. Same problem as the Boers. The whites don't go and hammer other whites in Rhodesia or in South Africa. So that's the way the whites are in Africa. But American whites aren't like that. So anyway, so he says, besides, I reasoned, regardless of how much you help these killers, they will very likely turn on you one day, as they have on other missionaries who have helped them. Let me pause there. I have got photos where missionaries have been murdered by these black terrorists. Everything he's saying is true. And there's an irony to this, is that in the war, the terrorists at various points made it their business to go and kill the white Christian missionaries. They did this a lot. So here are these white Christian missionaries teaching them all about Jesus and love, and we're all going to get along well and we're equal and blah, blah, blah. And then the black terrorists come and kill them. So anyway, so this white Christian American says, "They wouldn't hurt us," insisted the woman. "They love us." Willem coughed to keep from laughing. You see, the Boers know better. They know, man. You can't trust these sons of bitches, man. This is Africa. So Campbell answers, "Africans don't love, ma'am," I answered. "They don't even have that word in their vocabularies. You should know that. They have learned to love through our Christian teaching," says the woman. So the Christian teachings have taught them how to love. So anyway, Campbell says to her, "One of these days," I said, "the ones you have helped will be ordered to come back and kill you and all your Africans. If they refuse to do this, then they will be killed." Let me pause there. Campbell's totally right. The Russians and the Chinese, they taught these blacks, and there was strict discipline. And if they are told, go and kill those people, and they don't go and kill them, then they themselves are killed. They themselves are hunted down and killed. These people are ruthless. The system is ruthless. So he's telling them the truth, but this Christian with the Christian nonsense, she's not listening to him, and he knows what he's talking about. So anyway, he says the ones who kill them will come. If they refuse to do this, then they will be killed. The ones who kill them will come and kill you. So in other words, the blacks will be told to come and kill you, and if anybody refuses, those who refuse will be killed, and their killers will come and they'll kill you. So she continued to deny everything I said, so Willem and I got up and left. A few months later, this mission was attacked, and the white missionaries were murdered. So the same woman that he came and he warned her, they never listened, and later the blacks did come and did kill them. Now for this special little bit of information that Campbell publishes here that I think is fantastic. This is the first account I've got of somebody who'd been there who could tell me something like this. You won't find this in any of the books. And this is about Israel. Listen to this. "I knew little about the nature of Israel until a friend in special branch told me that it had been learned that the Israelis were supplying the communist terrorists against us. So let me stop there. Special Branch was a part of the police force in Rhodesia, and Special Branch were highly trained. They were actually excellent. Special Branch did so many excellent, excellent things. Even though Special Branch were police, the things those guys got up to, they were incredible. They're truly among the police. The things Special Branch got up to were just astounding. It's a British institution. It's a British, let's call it formation. But you'll find the British have it. All countries that are sort of derived from Britain have got a Special Branch. And Rhodesia had its own Special Branch. Special Branch are fantastic. They're excellent at spies. They're excellent at playing dirty tricks. They go and they kill who needs to be killed. Their information is excellent. So here he said, I knew little about the nature of Israel until a friend in Special Branch told me that it had been learned that the Israelis were supplying the communist terrorists against us. As a typical American, I'd had no interest in Middle East politics, but this was preposterous. How dare this poisoned dwarf, which had the gall to advertise itself as a country, aid and abet the most evil black murderers then working in Africa? Later, I saw that this made perfect sense. It was just one gang of white-hating terrorists helping another, a sort of professional courtesy. So, he then refers to Ian Smith. Ian Smith, to preserve his credibility with the security forces, spoke quietly to South Africa's Prime Minister, John Vorster, who objected to Golda Meir, who denied the charge categorically. Let me just pause there. Golda Meir was the female Prime Minister of Israel at the time. Golda Meir herself, I think, was a communist from Russia, I think. I think that's her actual background, Golda Meir. So she lies about it. So Rhodesia goes to South Africa, and South Africa goes and talks straight to the Prime Minister of Israel and says, you know, don't do this. So anyway, she denies that this happened, lying, of course, because we had the evidence. Vorster insisted that Meir put a stop to the Israeli treachery, or else all private aid from South African Jews would be prohibited. And that did it. You see, the Jews of South Africa are also like the Jews of Rhodesia. They're all sending money to Israel. And so Vorster at least makes a move, and he says, if you carry on helping the blacks, then we'll stop the money that comes from the South African Jews straight to Israel. Because all these Jews are busy helping build up their country in the Middle East, you see. Even though they live there. Rhodesian Jews also gave lots of money. All of them, doctors, were always donating money to Israel all the time. So he insisted that Meir put a stop to the Israeli treachery, or else all private aid from South African Jews would be prohibited. That did it. Meir then called it a rogue operation, apologized, and promised it would never happen again. So that is a very fascinating story. First time I've ever had somebody who had actual Special Branch contacts who actually talked about this, because in none of the Rhodesian and South African books from those times does anybody ever mention Israel in a bad light. And this is the only instance that I know of. So this I actually wanted to talk to Campbell about separately as an issue, because I thought this was something I'd never heard. None of the Rhodesians had mentioned this, but he was there, and he said his Special Branch pal told him about this. So all this stuff was hushed up. Those of us who lived in South Africa and Rhodesia, we never even heard about this stuff. But there you have it. Israel treacherously helping black terrorists. And in another video, I will show you what Israel did with Nelson Mandela. And in this case, they actually published it, put it out in the world. And that's another topic. You'll see another instance of Israel stabbing the whites of Southern Africa in the back. In this case, the South Africans. So, yeah, I thought this thing from Campbell was fantastic. And also just listening to Campbell, it'll give you some idea of how an American saw Rhodesia and how things worked. And it'll give you a little bit of an idea. The only difference I have is the notion that Ian Smith and the leaders set out to destroy Rhodesia, that they were part of the plan to destroy Rhodesia. That I don't think. That I don't think at all. However, I will say that there is some stuff that Campbell did tell me that if I get the chance and at some point I have time on my hands, because it'll require quite a bit of time, I do want to go and spend some time in a South African library and hunt for certain stuff, because there are things that Campbell told me that are very interesting about other whites and what they said, etc. So, yeah. But anyway, this will give you a little bit of an idea. Christians and blacks, this has not been working, okay? It's been a big failure. And those of you in America and elsewhere, I'm warning you. Christianity doesn't actually work for us in dealing with the others. In the end, it backfires. All these Christian ideas, liberal ideas, our enemies just take advantage and they just do what they want, man. They're ruthless. They're absolutely ruthless. They kill anybody. And helping these blacks, helping these terrorists. So there are these missionaries risking their lives, helping these blacks, teaching them love. And what happens? They all get killed. They all get killed, eh? Jewish communism comes and kills you in the end. These blacks aren't interested in this. They're taught, get power. Get power with the barrel of a gun. Who was it? The Chinese leader, Mao Zedong, he used to say, power comes out of the barrel of a gun. And that's how these blacks were taught here in Africa. Power comes out of the barrel of a gun. There's no other way to get it. End of story. And until white people relearn this lesson, that power comes out of the barrel of a gun. And if you are serious about power and politics, you have to get real, get serious. Politics, it's not for children. This is a dangerous game. You can get killed. And that's how the world really works, I'm afraid. So yeah, very interesting thing from Campbell. And I'm very indebted to my American friend who found it in the Liberty Bell. It was absolutely awesome to find this in writing from Campbell. Just so that you can see, this is another little hidden thing. And here you have Israeli treachery. Israel helping them. And later when white rule was gone, Israel was big buddies with Robert Mugabe, who came and seized white farms and everything. Israel was hobnobbing with him, selling him stuff to do crowd control. Later the Israelis got involved in diamonds. They were hobnobbing with these guys, rigging elections, all kinds of things. Jews, all the way. All the way. Typically filthy people, two-faced bastards. And you cannot trust these people. Cannot trust the blacks, cannot trust the Jews. So anyway, some thoughts for you from Rhodesia. Thanks to J.B. Campbell. But the good thing about Rhodesia that I'll repeat is that whites in Rhodesia had a real spirit. We stuck together. We didn't sell each other out. Traitors were rare. And the main traitor that the military guys pointed to was a guy called Ken Flower. Ken Flower is quite fascinating. And many people who've studied Rhodesian stuff in detail and gone through all the various books written by many people, including Flower himself, have said that Ken Flower, definitely, there's your traitor. There's your British spy. There's your British spy who really fucked it up for the whites. But Smith and the others, we don't think that they set out to deliberately destroy us. They took too much in the way of risks. They did the best they could for us. And our little rebellion was something quite unique in modern times, an actual rebellion against a first world power. And that we were able to survive as long as we did was not only due to our own ingenuity, but it was also due to the fact that Portugal, South Africa, France, without those three countries, we'd have been finished. We wouldn't have lasted a day. But thanks to those three countries, we survived a long time, and we punched way above our weight level for a couple of whites, for a quarter of a million whites. We didn't do bad. So just some more lessons, but we'll return to some other things that relate to this. You'll see what happened to the South Africans, what Israel did to the South Africans. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.